Ladies and gentlemen, joining us from around the globe, this is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik Palmgren with headquarters out of Sweden, Scandinavia. You can hear us worldwide at redicecreations.com. You can hear our free feed through iTunes, Stitcher, or subscribe to our RSS feeds or install our app at redicemobile.com. Then we also have redicemembers.com, the website for the full broadcast for our dedicated listeners and supporters, featuring the second hour of our radio program, plus all our other content, videos, films, TV episodes, music, commentary, and much more to come. Check out the Members app for Android and iPhone, and we also have RSS feeds for you to subscribe to from the Members website as well. I also want to say thanks for all the kind email with positive feedback and guest suggestions. We appreciate hearing from you, and we do the best we can to reply to everyone. Today, James Bamford is with us for an hour and 15 or so to talk about his work and career as an investigative journalist and author focusing on the NSA, the U.S. National Security Agency. His articles have appeared in dozens of publications, including Wired Magazine, The New York Times, The Washington Post. He's also done the TV program The Spy Factory for PBS. Stay with us as we discuss some of the history and activities of the NSA. And then we'll get into Snowden, the CIA, U.S. Cyber Command, cyber warfare, and how terrorism is being used as the excuse to take us further into a global brave new world of surveillance. And welcome, James Bamford. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio. We appreciate you taking some time off talking with us here today. We're very excited to have you with us. So thank you for coming on, sir.
My pleasure.
Excellent. Very good. Now, your first book was The Puzzle Palace on the NSA, released back in 1982. And that, of course, gives our audience a little bit of an idea of how long you've been doing this. And then in 2001, Body of Secrets, also on the NSA, and then most recently, the Shadow Factory. Tell us, James, what was it about the NSA that attracted you to spending so much, you know, time and years on researching and writing about this agency?
Well, I was in law school. I graduated from law school. I didn't really have a burning desire to practice law. But I did have a real interest in wanting to be a writer. I didn't really know how to go about being a writer, but I thought that I would give it a try. I was looking around for a topic to write about, and I was always interested in intelligence, espionage, that kind of thing. And I had heard about the NSA, but I discovered there had been no books ever written on the NSA. There had been a number on the CIA, but there had been no books ever written on the NSA. So I decided that I'd try to write the first book on NSA, and spent 3 years doing research on the book, and came out with The Puzzle Palace. So nobody else took up the cudgels after that. I went. I ended up working for ABC News. I was a producer for Peter Jennings. I was his investigative producer, and I wrote for New York Times Magazine, a bunch of other places. And for 20 years, nobody ever did another book on NSA. So my publisher said, you know, how'd you like to do another one? And I said, fine. So that's when I did Body of Secrets. And, then again, I decided to do another book on NSA, which was The Shadow Factory, after it was discovered that NSA had been doing all this illegal eavesdropping, and after the 9/11, deserved another look at the topic. So, just been, you know, keep writing on it.
Oh, indeed. Why is it you think that no one else picked up on this? I mean, considering the scope of the agency, the importance of this topic, why has no one else touched it like you have?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. First, the CIA was more accessible as a topic originally when I began writing Everybody heard of the CIA, and there were a fair number of people out there that had formerly worked for the CIA that would talk. So there were sources available if you really wanted to write about the CIA. But the NSA was much more difficult. First of all, there was no background research. You couldn't just go to a library and pick up material and write about it. So
right.
Everything had to be done from scratch. Second of all, there were no sources out there. Everyone I obtained as a source, I had to really work at because there were no – you couldn't pick up a newspaper and do a search and find other people that had worked at CIA that had that would talk about it. So it was very difficult finding sources. And then the third reason is because it's a very complex agency when it comes to collecting intelligence. The CIA with human intelligence, it's basically, recruiting agents, doing dead drops behind a tree someplace, or, it's not that hard to really understand how it works.
Right.
The NSA is very difficult because you had to understand a bit of physics, communications, and that kind of thing. So it was intimidating for most journalists who don't have any scientific or sort of physics background.
Technologically, some understanding as well, perhaps?
Yeah, you needed to understand how NSA did its eavesdropping, and it was... At the time, it was mostly by satellite, and you had to understand how they intercepted satellite communications and the footprints of satellite signals, and then breaking codes using computers. So the learning curve was fairly high. I mean, I had a liberal arts background. I didn't have a scientific background, so I had to do a lot of work trying to understand how NSA did all this. So it was not something that somebody could just say, oh, let me do a book on NSA, like you pretty much could on the CIA. You get some sources and they say, well, I worked at the Soviet Union and I recruited this guy here and, he passed me this information. It was far more complicated than that.
Right. And you, also got a lot of information out from Freedom of Information Act. And then consequently, I think you were also in some, kind of controversy surrounding that afterwards, right? There was threats of prosecution and such, wasn't there, after your first book?
Yeah. The NSA, when I first started writing this, they never anticipated anybody was ever going to write a book about NSA. It was just this self-confidence that they were too secret. Nobody would ever do that. And so when I first started writing about it, it was somewhat open. I could actually drive up to the front door of NSA, park my car, walk in the front door, have a seat in the lobby, get a cup of coffee, read a newspaper, and listen to people talking. I got the license numbers of the plates of the cars out front, and that gave me an idea. And then I ran them at the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and that told me who was actually running the agency. So there was a lot of, they had their guard down because they never thought anybody would ever do something like this. And now it's completely the opposite. You can't get anywhere near there without being shot at or it's insane now, the amount of security. But back then it was, it was much more easier because they weren't anticipating anybody would write a book about them. And the same way, to some degree, with the Freedom of Information Act. I sent a lot of FOI requests to NSA, and I did have a law degree, so I was able to word them in a way that I thought would get me the maximum amount of information and give them the least amount of defenses to use against me. And it ended up giving me a great deal of information, actually too much as far as the NSA was concerned, because at one point I submitted an FOI to the to the Justice Department for an investigation that they conducted, a very secret investigation into NSA's illegal spying. And they determined that NSA had been doing a great deal of illegal spying, and they came up with 20 potential charges, criminal charges against NSA. They actually read the Miranda rights to the people on the upper levels of the NSA. So I got the report from the Justice Department about all this, even though it was classified above top secret. But they had declassified it and released it to me. And when NSA found out that they had released this document to me, they went crazy, and they demanded that the Justice Department get it back from me, and that they reclassified it as top secret code word. And anyway, so they didn't pay any attention to NSA at the Justice Department under the Carter administration when I actually got it. But when the Reagan administration came in, much more conservative and friendly to NSA, so the Justice Department, the Attorney General, William French Smith, ordered his people to try to get it back from me. And I had to have meetings with them, with lawyers, and then they demanded I give it back, and I refused to give it back. And it led to a couple of showdowns, and eventually they threatened me with prosecution under the espionage statute if I didn't give it back. But we found a loophole in that, in the legal framework, and so we refused to give it back, and what the legal framework was this thing called the Executive Order on Secrecy, and it said once a document's been declassified, it can't be reclassified. But we just keep sending a letter back saying, well, you know, you can ask as many times as you want, but it doesn't change what the Executive Order on Secrecy says.
Right.
And then President Reagan decided to change the Executive Order on Secrecy to say once a document's been declassified, it can be reclassified. And but they couldn't go after me because of this legal principle called ex post facto. So they can't create a law and then punish somebody who did it when it wasn't a law. Anyway, the point was I kept the documents, used them in my book, and NSA has never been very friendly to me ever since.
Well, that's I definitely understand that, considering their stance and what they're involved in, and also, of course, where all this has been going. Of course, what you're talking about is the good old days, if I can call it that, of some agencies, at least, peripheral kind of openness. But all that's obviously changed after 9/11. We're going to get into more of that, and of course, all the scandals that's ongoing today with the agency. But just briefly, though, tell us, why was NSA originally set up? What was the tasks in the beginning?
NSA, if you trace its history back, it goes back 100 years, basically, to the end of the First World War. They broke codes and all that during the First World War, and they needed an agency during peacetime to do code breaking and eavesdropping, very, very secret agency. So they created this organization in 1920 called the Black Chamber. And it basically did the same thing. They didn't have, they needed information in order to, they needed communications in order to access the data. So the head of the Black Chamber back in the early 1920s had secret meetings with the heads of the telecom companies in the U.S., Western Union, and so forth. Telegrams were sort of the internet of the day, and they secretly cooperated and gave NSA access to all their telegrams every single day. And so that's pretty much been going on ever since. The NSA itself was created in 1952 as an outgrowth of the code-breaking activities of World War II. But again, it had the same purpose of the Black Chamber back in the 1920s. And again, it needed access to the communications going through the United States. So just like the Black Chamber, it made secret deals with the telecom companies and got secret access to the all the telegrams coming into, going out of, or going through the U.S. at the time.
Huh. Do you know if the companies basically were in a position where they could say no to this, but they agreed to do it anyway?
Yeah, I actually read a great deal about this in the Puzzle Pals. There were numerous internal discussions over whether they should do this. The general counsels of the principal lawyers of the companies were arguing, virtually all arguing that they shouldn't, because the law you know, it's against the law, and the people could go to jail. I mean, the companies could get into trouble. But they eventually all agreed to do it because the originally it was the head of the equivalent of the NSA. It actually started in 1946 when they started this program. And he went around to each of the companies. Each of the companies originally denied it, originally said no, and then they all came all around and agreed to it. And eventually they got a letter, I think, from the attorney general saying, at least while we're in power, we won't prosecute you if this is discovered. And then they wanted, they said, that's not good enough. We have to hear it from the president himself. And they refused to give him a letter from the president, but they sort of winked and they said the president's okayed this. And that would have been President Truman at the time. And then they all went along with it, and they went along with it for 30 years until 1975, when it was discovered by the investigating committee in Congress called the Church Committee, run by Frank Church, a senator. And so once it was discovered, Senator Church said it was the most invasive surveillance program in the history of the United States, and they closed it down. It was called Operation Shamrock. And then they began looking for a reform, and that was how they created the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, so that anytime NSA wanted to eavesdrop on anybody in the U.S., instead of just going to the telegraph companies or telecom companies and making a secret deal, they'd have to go through this court first, this secret court. So that's how the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court became created.
Very good. Now, so let's talk about what's going on today. We have the connections to, of course, U.S. Cyber Command. We have the general commander of this, of both the NSA and the Cyber Command, Keith Alexander. What kind of activities are they involved in today? And just maybe we can, you know, get a brief overview of care. Of course, there's the official version of this, and then there's the unofficial version that's been coming out now through Snowden and some of the other whistleblowers that for years have been talking about this, you included, of course.
Well, what Cyber Command is was set up to do was just created a few years ago, and it was put under the director of the NSA. And as you mentioned, I just did a cover story on this topic, a cover story on the director of the NSA, who's now head of the Cyber Command, Keith Alexander, four-star general. And it came out, ironically, it came out at virtually the same moment that the Snowden affair exploded. So the timing was fairly good for that. It's in the July issue of Wired in the U.S. But what I focused on was General Alexander's role as head of this new Cyber Command. And it's a very, very few people really understand what this is, but it's an entirely secret organization that has its own military. It has its own Army, Navy, and Air Force. General Alexander is in charge of the 2nd U.S. Army, the 24th U.S. Air Force Wing, and the 10th U.S. Navy Fleet. So he's got his own Army, Navy, and Air Force under him. And what they do is they launch cyber attacks. That's what they do. Sometimes they break into foreign computers and plant. This is all done over cyber. Break into the computers and plant things so that they could read what the computers are saying, and other times they could plant malware that could destroy the computers. And what I focused on here was a topic that really hadn't been discussed much, and it's really the most potentially dangerous of all the activities, and that's what they call kinetic cyber warfare. Kinetic is when you break something or you destroy something. And this is where they use offensive cyber warfare to destroy something in some other country. And in this case, the first case they used it was in Iran, where they used it to destroy the infrastructure for their nuclear development infrastructure for uranium reprocessing. They destroyed the centrifuges and so forth. So this was the first act in history of the use of cyber-destructive warfare or cyber-kinetic warfare. And it's very dangerous. I mean, you can use this to blow up dams, blow up power plants, destroy the electric grid in a country. There was one document I got, and I don't think I actually put it in the article for the, because we didn't have the space, but there was a document from NSA that was saying during the Vietnam War, it took 120 sorties or 120 missions and something like 3,000 something bombs to destroy the North Vietnamese power infrastructure, electric grid, and so forth.
Yeah.
And today it would just take a few hits on a keyboard, and you could do that in a country now, as long as you knew exactly where to send the malware and so forth. So that's where we are now. We're at the stage where NSA has become a warfighting organization capable of basically launching a war. And these are wars fought with computers that could actually destroy buildings and dams and everything else.
Unbelievable. Yeah, it's a true cyber terrorist. People might call Stuxnet as well, of course. Part United States and Israel, I believe, to attack this. And was this actually traced back to the NSA, Stuxnet, or are you talking about something else?
No, Stuxnet was traced back to, you know, you have to separate NSA and Cyber Command. Both of them worked on it. The NSA was, you know, they're both under the same person. I mean, it's hard to...
Exactly, yeah.
talking about two different organizations, but they're both run by the same person.
Yeah.
The way it worked was that NSA developed the what they call the probes, the devices or the malware that actually gets inserted into the foreign computers, in this case into Iran's computers within their Natanz nuclear reprocessing facility. Or uranium processing facility, and that did a probe. It looked at all the infrastructure within that that facility and mapped it out, and it said what kind of software was being used, how many computers there were, this little probe would go in there and it would gather all that intelligence, and then it would retransmit that that information back to NSA, which would give NSA an enormous blueprint of what everything looked like in there. And if they know what kind of software it is, what kind of accesses there are, then they design the warhead. And the warhead is designed to go in and hide itself and then masquerade itself, basically, by a number of techniques. And then gradually destroy whatever it is that they're trying to destroy. In this case, it was the centrifuges. And what it would do would be to rock these centrifuges back and forth, basically, or at least rock the rotors that are spinning it, so that it basically broke them and. To do it in such a way that the people in the facility thought that it was a fault of the centrifuges and not something external by another country like the United States. It was only discovered because somebody from that was allowed into the facility with a computer plugged his computer into the Iranian military's computers in there and then unplugged it and took it home and began using it as personal PC, basically, and interconnected with the internet. Once he did that, the bug that his computer had been infected, once he plugged it into the computer inside the plant, and the infection spread across the internet. And then it was discovered by some cybersecurity specialists, and they basically analyzed it almost like a anthropologist might analyze a some newly discovered bone or something. They were able to determine pretty much where this was created, which was the United States. What its purpose was to destroy the reprocessing infrastructure in Iran, and gave enormous amounts of detail. So there was no question that the U.S. was involved, although the U.S. continues to deny it just for the sake of it. But and then in the article, I also say how the Israeli involvement, which was they had agents, human agents in Iran, and they were able to recruit people in Iran who actually supplied the electronics for the military and the intelligence community. And so the Israelis were able to bug the equipment and or get the bugs that the U.S. gave, basically, and allow them to be implanted into the computers in the plant. So it was a very complicated operation, but it succeeded until it was discovered.
Yeah. Now, it's really after 9/11, it seems like, also that the NSA get, majority of their, power, really, and funding as well. Despite this, there's been a number of intelligence failures, of course, along the way, including 9/11. And officially, then, all of this is done to keep America safe. But despite this, there's now been a kind of a transformation, and the agency is increasingly turning its, as you term it, its high-tech ears on the American public. So what are we to make of this? Why is this the case? What's going on?
Well, this all happened after 9/11, and it was because the terrorists were in the United States at the time when the attack took place. It wasn't external, it was internal. So then there was this movement to begin eavesdropping domestically. The Bush administration decided that even though they probably could have gotten permission to do this, if they simply went to Congress in secret and asked for permission to bypass the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, they probably could have done it. But instead they chose to go around the law, to violate the law. And they began eavesdropping domestically on U.S. citizens without ever getting a warrant from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. And that lasted for several years, about 2.5 years or so, until it was discovered by the New York Times, and they published a front-page article exposing the activity. But what happened was, instead of stopping the activity, they basically just kept it going. The only change was that they weakened the law. So instead of stopping the activity, they basically increased it, and they increased it by secretly changing the law to allow them to do it. So even though a lot of the American public assumed that after the exposure and after the it was determined that the NSA had broken the law, and the Bush administration had broken the law, they assumed that this had been stopped, when in reality it had only been expanded.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. Now, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Edward Snowden as we begin to tie all these things together here. Why is it, do you think, that this particular whistleblower get the attention that he does, when there's been a number of others along the way, Russ Tice, also Thomas Drake, who I believe you've worked with or that you know. There are others in other agencies like Sibel Edmonds, Susan Lindauer, and numerous others that I failed to mention here. But why did Ed Snowden become such a worldwide story, do you think?
Well, you mentioned a lot. I've interviewed a lot of whistleblowers myself. Adrian Kinney, for example, told me he's dropping during the Bush administration, even on journalist communications and so forth. And in my Wired article last year, I interviewed Bill Benny, who was a senior official at NSA, and told me all about access to Verizon and access to AT&T and all that. The difference is, they all said this verbally, and I wrote it, you know, I wrote it in Wired or my books, different places, and the NSA would then come out and deny it all. When my article in Wired came out last summer, you know, I had as credible a witness as you can possibly get. Bill Benny, he'd been there almost 40 years. He was the civilian equivalent of a general.
Yeah.
He was the person who designed the entire eavesdropping system that was used around the world. And then he quit because he objected to them using that same system domestically. Well, I mean, he had enormous credibility, but then General Alexander came out a few days or a week later or whatever and began denying it all. We don't do that. We don't eavesdrop on Americans. We don't collect data on Americans and all that. It was all lying, but, you know, he came out and he had credibility because he was a four-star general, head of NSA and so forth. So, and all I had was, you know, Bill Benny and a few other whistleblowers, but you know, when you get the mainstream press here, they're going to listen to what General Alexander has to say because he's a four-star general, head of NSA. So that's why I didn't make a lot of news. I mean, you know, I can completely understand that. That's the way things work here. And I think Snowden saw that. Snowden mentioned Benny a few times. And, you know, he saw that when he was making his decision to become a whistleblower, that it's fairly, you know, it'll make a blip in the headlines in terms of him coming out and telling a reporter, telling the New York Times or the Washington Post or Wired or me or whoever what's going on. The only way you could ever get them to the only way you could ever get around their lying about this activity is actually show the proof. And I think that's one of the reasons he decided to actually walk out with the documents, because he saw the previous whistleblowers would just be shunted aside by the NSA as being liars or whatever, and that the only way to prove that it's actually the NSA that's doing the lying that is to walk out with the documents. And that's what he did. So he filled up, I don't know, computers or flash drives, whatever, with his data, and that's what we're seeing right now. So it's extraordinary to me, certainly, having written this for years and years, to actually see the documents. You know, you get people talking about this, but to actually see the top secret FISA court order or the slides where it describes PRISM and other programs, it's quite extraordinary.
So tell us a little bit about PRISM for people who haven't, you know, been under a rock for a while here. What is the nature of PRISM and what does it do?
Well, PRISM's gotten all the attention, but, you know, if you look at the slide, actually, the slide has two programs on it. One is called Upstream, the other one is called PRISM. To explain it, just go back a little bit to this program called Echelon. A number of years ago, Echelon was NSA's program, worldwide interception program, which is now obsolete. But at the time, what they did was they intercepted worldwide communications using large satellite dishes, because most communications, international communications, went by satellite. In the late 90s, everything's changed. It became much more efficient and cheaper to send communications by fiber optic cables. So the world became wrapped in fiber optic cables, undersea cables, underground cables, and so forth. So NSA had a change, and they pretty much got rid of the satellite interception, which was becoming less and less used internationally. And they began focusing on collecting data from these cables. It's much more difficult with satellite, all you had to do was get a big dish out there, and all that communication just fell into the dish. With fiber optic cables, you actually have to make, there's really only two choices. Either you get a submarine and you tap the cables undersea, which is very difficult, although the U.S. has developed a submarine to do that, although from what I understand, it's not very successful.
Hmm.
But the other way to do it is you have to make an agreement with the telecom companies because they control the cables. They own the cables, and they control the junction points where the cables all come together. And that was what PRISM was. What PRISM and Upstream was. Upstream is getting access to the cables, the raw cables, basically. Getting access to the cables without having to go through the internet companies. So they've been pretty successful at that, at getting these filters at junction points where these cables all come together. And they can collect probably about 80% of the communications they're after that way, without the involvement of the internet companies. But for the 20% or whatever that they, and that's upstream. Upstream is where they're collecting it directly from the cables themselves. And then PRISM is where they're working it out. They need the other 20% or whatever. They have to get it directly from the cable company, or rather from the internet companies, from Yahoo or from Google or whatever.
Right.
And so those two programs put together are basically what Echelon used to be a long time ago.
That's right, and they had facilities, as you said, all around the world. Over in UK, they had a big facility as well. And one thing that's happened consequently here as well is that the EU and US relations have hardened because of this, as it was found out earlier now in July that certain countries were targeted, Germany, France, etc. Did they not really know this, that they that this is going on? I mean, when I look at this, James, when I see the massive, offices, the new data center up in Bluffdale, Utah, with the, what's going on in Maryland at Fort Meade and everything, is like, this is what the agency is designed to do. It's designed to take all the data, spy on everything and everybody. And not that it's a good thing, of course, but I'm surprised that people are surprised by it. Are not you?
Well, I guess I'm not that surprised that they're surprised at it, because there's the average American's attention span when it comes to these things is very limited, when you're dealing with NSA, it's very complex. So, it is good that finally it's starting to come out. This is not new. I mean, I don't know. I think, as you mentioned, this just really isn't new. They've been doing this for decades.
Yeah.
They were doing it under Echelon. It was just a different technology. I mean, they were still eavesdropping on Germany, the people in Germany. It was just that it was done by satellite.
That's right. Yeah.
The way it works is after World War II, there was the English-speaking world pretty much came together with this agreement called the UK-USA Agreement, the Yakuza Agreement, and so that was the United States, Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada. And they divided up the world into spheres of eavesdropping capabilities, so that the U.S. could eavesdrop, obviously, much easier on South America and other places. And where we had military bases, we could eavesdrop. Like from Korea, we could eavesdrop on China and so forth. And England, for example, could eavesdrop on Europe, Western Europe, and Russia, up to the Urals or whatever, fairly easily. And Australia could eavesdrop on Southeast Asia. So the idea is you divide up the world so that you're able to listen to everywhere, or at least as much as possible, and then you share it all, so that if we had a target in Southeast Asia, we send the name or the email address or whatever it would be to Australia, and they would try to collect it, and vice versa, and they share it all. So it's still going on. It's just that it's now being done by cable. And the way it worked was that the United States was always considered the first party, And then Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the UK were considered second parties. And there was agreement that the first party and the second party wouldn't spy on each other. But then there were the third parties. The third parties are other countries in Europe and Japan, I guess, probably a few other countries. And there's no agreement there. There's agreement on sharing intelligence, but no agreement on not spying on them. So that's how you get the NSA, where it came out from the Snowden material, that NSA was picking up half a billion communications a month from Germany. And the way that works, it doesn't have a bug on everybody's telephone.
Sure. Yeah.
It's, as I just mentioned, it's by putting a filter on the cables that are going into and coming out of Germany. And there's half a billion communications that pass a month through those filters. And so nobody knows what's in those filters, but there are no laws preventing NSA from eavesdropping on anybody outside the United States unless they're American citizens. So that's why I think the people in Europe should start getting concerned, because it's true that every country spies, but the U.S., spies with the equivalent of a nuclear weapon, and they spy with the equivalent of a howitzer, maybe. for simple reason that the U.S. has all the major internet companies within the United States. I mean, it's part of that PRISM program. They have cooperative agreements with the 9 largest internet companies. Well, you know, Sweden doesn't have the 9 largest internet companies in there, and Germany doesn't have it, and that's why the United States is in a much better position to spy on the rest of the world.
Right.
So it's a transit point. Almost, I think it's 99% of all internet communications passes through the United States one time or another. And phone calls also. Somebody from Japan wants to call somebody in Europe, the odds are the communications is going to go through the United States. So the U.S. is in a very good position to eavesdrop, and since there are no laws or prohibitions about eavesdropping on anybody else in the world, they
do it because they can.
And because they've got the money. After 9/11, it was like dump trucks full of cash, just dumped it at NSA. They had so much money, they didn't know what to do, so they had to go out and hire contractors. And so all of a sudden, now contractors do about half of, make up at least probably half of what NSA does. So the people with the earphones on, sitting at these listening posts, like the one in Georgia, which has 4,000 positions, you might be sitting next to, if you're working for NSA, the person with the earphones on next to you may be working for Booz Allen, and the person on the other side may be working for SAIC or Lockheed Martin or Boeing. Or
right.
All these companies have enormously lucrative contracts to do exactly what NSA is doing, eavesdropping. And one problem with that is that they're not accountable. You can't send a Freedom of Information Act to Booz Allen or to Boeing. They're private companies.
Exactly. I think that's why it's so handy as well to work, hand in glove like they do in that relationship, because you can privatize, if you will, the spying as well. And if something goes wrong, you can blame that individual company, let's say, and, scandal happens, they're shut down or whatever. But then, a couple of months, you start up something new, you really have, or we already have a number of companies that can just take over that role right away.
Right. I mean, Edward Snowden's a perfect example. Edward Snowden never worked for NSA. Never once did he ever work at NSA. I think, originally he started off as a security guard at some NSA facility at the University of Maryland or something. But he never worked for NSA. He worked for contractors. He worked for Dell Corporation, and then he worked for Booz Allen. So, and look at all the access he's had. It's a perfect example of how the corporate world has taken over, where pretty much become a second NSA.
let me ask you this as well, considering Snowden a little bit on his background, as he's been part of CIA before, and in your Wired article, The Secret War, you wrote, in April, as part of its 2014 budget request, the Pentagon asked Congress for $4.7 billion for increased cyberspace operations, nearly $1 billion more than the 2013 allocation. At the same time, budgets for the CIA and other agencies were cut by almost the same amount, $4.4 billion. A portion of the money going to NSA will be used to create 13 cyber attack teams. And so to going on from this, there has been speculations that there also is an intra-agency kind of war going on, a covert war, if you will, between the CIA and the NSA in terms of who gets to handle what and who gets budget, etc. Your comments on this?
Well, that's right. It's really the only game in town right now. And that's why you have so many contractors pretty much going to the feeding trough at NSA and Cyber Command, because cyber is the, like I said, the only game in town. It's the one area that, despite all the sequesters and all this other layoffs and so forth, the billions and billions are going to Cyber Command, because that's looked at as the next, as the future of warfare and the future of intelligence. So you've got all these companies. If you actually drive up the bottom of Washington Parkway, NSA is hidden off to the right behind a lot of trees on the right, and then on the left behind a whole bunch of trees on the other side of Baldwin Washington Parkway is the industrial community for NSA. It's all the big buildings for SAIC, Boeing, and Booz Allen and so forth, and they're all gearing up now to take part in the cyber war, because they're all building their own cyber centers and everything else, because it's the next big thing on the horizon, and it's the only thing that's really making a lot of money. I mean, the CIA, its job is basically human intelligence, which it hasn't been very good at, and it's just not very capable in terms of human intelligence. I mean, look at the Iraq War, all that human intelligence we got from Ahmed Chalabi and so forth. It was all bogus. So CIA began switching to drones, blowing people up with drones. That became their next big thing. And now it looks like they're the main focus for intelligence and for warfare now is going to be NSA for intelligence and cyber war for offensive warfare activity. And all comes under General Alexander. And again, this is somebody that he could walk in front of the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and not only would nobody on the street recognize him, probably 90% of the people in the White House wouldn't even recognize him. So he's a guy that's extremely mysterious, very hard to get information about. I mean, writing this cover story on him was not exactly easy. So, you get the CIA person who, CIA director, who will occasionally hold a press conference, or, and it's usually somebody that's fairly well known, like Petraeus or whatever. The NSA director is always hidden in, super secrecy.
Indeed. Is there a possibility that the CIA has an interest in putting the NSA in a bad light in the media and in people's general awareness?
Well, I don't think the CIA doesn't have to do anything. Ed Snowden's doing a pretty good job himself there. So, but
considering his background in the CIA, is there a possibility something else is going on here?
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think the CIA has anything to do with this. CIA is sort of in a confusing mess right now in terms of the changes, because Petraeus had to leave, and now they're debating what to do with drones and so forth.
Right.
The CIA plays an important role in cyber. I focused on NSA, and I briefly mentioned CIA, but the CIA actually plays a very important role. The CIA actually develops the warhead for the cyber. The NSA develops the probes and all that sort of thing. and the intelligence, Kluxi intelligence, and so forth. But there's a unit within the CIA, the National Clandestine Service, and a unit within there called the I don't know if I can think of it right now. It's the Office of Proliferation, counter-proliferation unit. And they're the ones who actually designed the warhead. That's the thing that actually caused the destruction of the centrifuges. So the two work together. And the CIA plays also an important role. A number of years ago, there was this battle between CIA and NSA over who's going to basically break into foreign communications facilities to plant bugs and so forth. The NSA was arguing that it should do it since, you know, its job is signals intelligence, and that's what it you know, it eavesdrops on communications. And the CIA was saying that there's two issues here. One is information in motion and information at rest. And NSA is responsible for information at motion. In other words, as it goes through a fiber optic cable or as it goes through a satellite or whatever, that's NSA. But if it's a hard drive, if it's an actual computer sitting in somebody's office or in a building, that's information at rest, and that comes under the CIA, and they won that argument. So now the way it works, so if you're in China or someplace, if you're the CIA in China, your job is to recruit somebody at the Chinese telecom companies and somebody that works actually in the, you know, some of the key locations there, and you give them, you know, a bugged piece of computer equipment or whatever, some key piece of equipment that he goes in and he switches out what's in there and puts your device in there. It's an identical looking device. Mm-hmm. And from then on, NSA could get the information. So the actual, that's where the two groups come together. And NSA has a very secret group. It's called the Tailored Access organization, and they're the ones who actually collect that from the bugs and so forth, and they're the ones who create the probes to go into the foreign computer systems to collect intelligence and map them out and so forth. So this is all very complex, but the two agencies actually work together, CIA and the NSA, on this aspect of cyber warfare.
Okay. Now, let's talk about data mining then and what they're doing with all this data. I mean, listening to all internet traffic with these filters, as you explained, this include emails, Skype, as we're talking over, phones, you know, anything basically that they can. How concerned do you think that the average individual should be that they're being, I don't know, targeted? Because, I mean, we're not talking about humans listening in on all of this. So, I mean, this data is being stored up in Bluffdale once it's complete or already has to have, I mean, Yoda byte, capacity at this stage. But who do you think is in Big Brother's database, if we can term it that?
Well, there's a lot of people in there. When you look at this mass collection of data and the enormous numbers of people they put on these watch lists, the basic list, not the do not fly list, but the basic list from which all the other lists like the do not fly lists are compiled. I mean, the basic list is called the TIDE list, TIDE, and that contains 875,000 names. I don't know how many are Americans, but, you know, there aren't 875,000 terrorists in the world. now, when you get into the real problems here is that, for example, Ted Kennedy was on the do not fly list. It took him 3 months to get off it. It's Ted Kennedy. Hmm. There's a lot of people that are on these lists that have no idea, and they think of themselves as having no reason to be on there, which is true, except a lot of people are, like Ted Kennedy. And you could be on there for any number of reasons. Suppose you move into a house that the previous owner was on the target list or something, and now you're associated with that address. Or you've got a cell phone number that's one number away, and they make a mistake and get your number. Or you accidentally, you know, you... son's doing some research on Iran, so he calls up the Iranian embassy and asks them questions or whatever. All these things could possibly trigger the algorithm to put you on the list. You know, you're calling the Iranian embassy or whatever, asking questions or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's all kinds of ways. I don't know what the algorithm is. But you've got an algorithm that manages to get 875,000 names on that watch list.
And that's just the official one. I mean, I'm talking about the ones we don't know about yet also, right?
Right. And that's the one I know about. I mean, you could Google the Tide watch list and you could actually read about it. But but yeah, there's all kinds of watch lists, and each agency has their own and so forth. And I did that cover story for Wired last year on the data center they're building in Bluffdale, Utah. It's going to be 1 million square feet. And there's a number of purposes for that. First of all, it'll serve as the cloud. So NSA picks up all this information all over the world, and including information it gets from domestically. And it's now has a place to store it all, this one huge facility. And then that will act as, in essence, the cloud, so that NSA analysts at headquarters or NSA analysts in Georgia or Texas, wherever they happen to be, just use that as sort of an external hard drive. They're all connected by fiber optic cables to the secure fiber optic cables to the data center in Bluffdale, and then they just access whatever data is in there. Now, it's also possible that they could use it as sort of a buffer, in a sense, so that they could target not just individuals, but they could target whole sections of the world, for example, maybe everything going in and out of Iran, for example, or everything in and out of Afghanistan. What's possible, I don't know if they're going to be doing it, but it's possible that they could buffer that information into Bluffdale. What I mean when I say that is that they could be taking everything from, say, just using an example, Iran, taking everything in real time, and then it would go into this buffer at Bluffdale, a certain number of servers or whatever, and it would store all that for days, a week, or a month, or whatever. And then as new information comes in, the old information goes out, but it buffers it for a month. And the advantage of that is if all of a sudden there's a nuclear test or something, or a missile launch or whatever, then they could go back 2 weeks or 3 weeks and see what was going on. So that, you know, and you can do that. I'm just using Iran for example, but if it was decided to do so, they could do it for American communications too.
I see.
So we give the option of storing data instead of just having the filters. And, you know, if you think of this as a huge fire hose, the fiber optic cables, and then you put a filter on it with certain names to collect. You're collecting it as it goes by in real time, but you're not able to store it. And that might be one of the functions of Bluffdale also.
Now, there's a few more questions I'm going to squeeze in here, gents, before we let you go for this time. One has to do with a little bit more of a sci-fi version of this, I guess. But do you think that it would be possible from their point of view then that they could, with the right algorithms or, let's say, with the really advanced artificial intelligence that the many companies have been working on now for many years, that they actually are looking at some stage to be able to, quote-unquote, predict potential future events, almost like a pre-crime type scenario? What do you think is possible? Is this what they're looking for, and is this why they're collecting so much data of all, you know, seemingly mundane information, if you know what I mean?
Well, I actually wrote about that in the Shadow Factory, where they have an organization called IARPA, which stands for Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's like ARPA, which is for the Pentagon. This is IARPA for the intelligence community. And one of the things that they were looking at for NSA is this predictive capability by using some degree intuition and the calculating using the supercomputers to calculate possibilities and so forth. I mean, one of the real dangers here, which you know people should really start thinking about, is not just this two-way communications. NSA has been doing that since it began, actually since the 1920s. It's been focusing on two-way communications. Somebody on a telephone talking to somebody else, or somebody on an email talking to somebody else, somebody on a telegram sending it to somebody else. The dangers you're getting now, I think, are when you're going beyond that and you're getting the information that only you have and that you're not sharing with anybody else. And you get that information, almost stream of conscious information, and you get that by accessing Google, for example. In other words, there may be things I won't share with anybody, but I'm interested in it, and I'll Google it.
Right.
So my fingertips become extensions of my brain, and the Google becomes an extension of my brain. So as I'm thinking of things, I'm entering it into Google. So if you have access to somebody's Google account, you're able to basically watch what they're thinking as they're thinking of it, even though they're not communicating it with another person.
Yeah.
And I think as technology advances, and you know, you got Google Glass now, and you get there's all these advances that are coming like monthly. The problem is letting the law slip way behind the technology. And the people at NSA, these are people that want to keep pushing, and the law is an impediment to a large degree. And unless you have aggressive people in Congress, like Senator Wyden or Senator Udall, they're going to push as far as they can, and the law is going to continually get further and further behind.
Indeed. Now, is this really about terrorism, though, and catching terrorists at the end of the day? I mean, that's the excuse, as I see it, that they are taking advantage of the situation that even some speculate has been created in this way, so that these, you know, intelligence failures that happen, you know, along the way, like many have said, 9/11, but also more recently in Boston, but ultimately that this is the incentive then that leads to the NSA, Cyber Command, CIA, other agencies to get more funding, bigger infrastructure support from government, you know, Big Brother. I mean, this is, as you are alluding to as well, is turning our planet into a brave new world, if you will, right, James?
Well, that's true. You know, there's a number of real issues here that people really don't look at. First of all, NSA was never designed to do this. NSA was created after World War II for one purpose. That was to prevent a surprise attack by the Soviet Union with nuclear missiles. That was its job. Collecting intelligence was ancillary, but its main job was preventing a surprise attack by the Soviet Union. Now it's been morphed into something it was never designed for. It was never designed to find people around the world who might be considered terrorists or whatever. That was never its design, so it's not good at it. I mean, it missed the first World Trade Center attack. It missed the attack on the USS Cole. It missed the attack on the U.S. embassies in East Africa. It missed 9/11. It missed the Times Square bomber, the underwear bomber, the Boston bombers, even though almost all those people were communicating both entirely foreign or internationally. They were all involved at one point or another making phone calls. Boston bombing, or the people involved in the Boston bombing were calling Chechnya and Dagestan. They were flying back and forth. the underwear bomber that was entirely in Yemen and Nigeria, had nothing to do with U.S. communications, and the Times Square bomber, or the Times Square attempt, he was communicating back and forth to Pakistan, and then you have 9/11, and then they were communicating back and forth to Yemen, and on and on and on. You know, the coal that was entirely foreign, and the attack on the embassies were entirely foreign, and so forth. So if NSA just focused on foreign communications and doing a really good job on looking for terrorists over there, and trying to find the needles instead of continually building the haystack, you know, maybe it would solve these things. But the problem is now it's bringing in all this U.S. communications, and none of these people were, you know, the way to have found these people was to focus on the foreign communications, and so they're taking this agency, and it was supposed to do one thing, and it's not doing it anymore. It's kind of, you know, it's this bizarre agency now that has its main goal of collecting information, and yet these terrorist events still take place. I mean, they pointed to this fact that they were able to get, they said 50, helped stop 50 terrorist incidents around the world and 10 in the U.S., and then they refused to even give any hints of what they were. So the credibility is not very strong. And one of the ones, I think they only mentioned two. One was this the Zazi case in New York, the subway, attempted subway bombing case or whatever. And that was largely by information given to the NSA by the British, who picked up the first indication, the email address and all that. That was given to NSA. It wasn't through the PRISM program. And the only other one that they really point to, which is rather absurd, is this case involving some guy that they identified in San Diego who sent $8,000 to some group in Somalia. I mean, that if that's a high point, you know, great. They would have stopped this guy from sending $8,000 to the, you know, some group in Somalia. I mean, so what?
Yeah.
That's what we're spending all these billions for.
Well, exactly. Yeah, I know. And what you've mentioned here is, of course, the official versions of these events as well, coming out from government and the agencies as well. And my question has always been, are we really to accept that there's nothing else going on here, just as I said, using the situation to further, you know, their agenda? And I'm just kind of throwing that out there for people to think about. But one last question for you, Jens, before I let you go here. Where is this going? Or let me ask you this, actually, first. Should any agency or government or company be allowed to spy on people in any capacity? And if they are, and if that goes unchallenged, what are we looking at in the future? How far will this go, do you think?
Well, you know, the government has a right to eavesdrop on somebody as long as they could show that there's probable cause to an independent judge that the person's involved in some criminal activity. That's been the rule forever, and it works out fairly well. I mean, there's a check and a balance there. The problem with the way the system is now is there are no checks and balances. They did have this FISA court, but even though it almost never turns the government down, it still wasn't weak enough for the Bush administration, so they basically neutered it. So now you have almost, and now it's officially neutered under law, where they can get a warrant to eavesdrop on, or what they call an order to have Verizon turn over all their records and so forth. So it's gotten way out of control, and there's very few people in Congress that will fight against it. And the reason for that is, I mean, people have to really understand why this is happening like this. You have people in Congress, and there's this fear, enormous fear, that their opponent is going to accuse them of being weak on terrorism. So if they vote against granting NSA more money or more power or whatever, then the next elections, you know, suppose there's another Boston bombing or whatever. The next election, somebody's going to say, that wouldn't have happened if he didn't vote against that measure, or if he didn't vote against more money for this or for that. And so you get this fear by Congress of ever voting against a terrorism bill, something, mm-hmm. something going for terrorism. And the irony here is it's this terror hysteria in the United States that really has to be overcome before any other changes are made. You know, we've had maybe 20 cases of people being killed in the U.S. since 9/11 that might be even tangentially associated with al-Qaeda, and that's counting that the 13 deaths by Major Hassan and so forth. And the three people in Boston, which were really not that much al-Qaeda related. In that same period of time, though, we've had around 330,000 Americans die of from handguns and assault weapons and so forth in the U.S. Yet there's no legislation to restrict how many assault weapons a person can buy.
But they're trying to push that in, though, aren't they?
They're trying
to... Feinstein and everything, that's on its way, right?
To do what?
To ban, you know, assault rifles and...
But it's never worked. They never work it. And yet that's where most of the deaths come from. They've never been able to pass a law restricting... in Virginia, for example, some legislatures tried to pass a law restricting the number of assault weapons or the number of guns you can buy a month, and they couldn't even do that. So you get this bizarre situation where the fear of terrorism is so strong that you can't even carry a bottle of shampoo onto an airplane.
Right, yeah.
But you can buy as many assault weapons as you want at a gun store. I mean, does that make any sense?
Well, this exact. I mean, your point is well taken and very good. There are so many other areas in you know life, basically, where there are so many different kinds of dangers. I mean, even properly prescribed, you know, medication. There's like hundreds and thousands of deaths in America alone on those things. And there's you know the car issue, you know, issue of traffic safety and all the things. And yet, but on this one issue, in terms of you know terrorism. You know, America and the world in the extension are asked to basically reform the entire world and this, you know, for the sake of this security when it's very, very few numbers that actually that this is involved in terms of deaths. So your point is very good.
Well, and that's why this thing, I mean, it really boils down to that one issue there that it's this enormous fear over, unreasonable fear over terrorism that's allowing the U.S. to spend all this money and on agencies like NSA to do all this spying, because it's terrorism is always the first thing they say. It's not preventing you know nuclear attack from Russia or something. It's terrorism, and then you use that anytime you want more money for eavesdropping, more money for NSA to build up cyber command, whatever. Terrorists we have to fight or whatever, and I just don't see it changing. That's why I think the fact that Snowden came out with all this information was extremely helpful. It sort of put some of this in perspective, not only in the U.S. but around the world. And you know, who knows what else he's got up his flash drive or whatever. I mean, although. You know, if he accepts asylum in Russia and Putin insists on his continued silence in the future, who knows if we'll see any more. But, you know, that's...
Do you know, by the way, if he's been let into to Russia, or is that just speculation at this point?
Well, he's actually asked for... temporary asylum in Russia.
Right. Yeah. For
that yesterday. And Russia had already said that they would give him asylum on one condition. The condition is that he stop publishing his secrets. I mean, Putin's very smart intelligence official. He spent his whole life in intelligence. And,
yeah.
And he could see the value of this, first of all, if he hasn't already, through electronic means, he'd be hoping to get all of whatever Snowden has. And, you know, if you're intelligence, the last thing you want is everybody to know that. So he wouldn't want the he wouldn't want the Chinese or anybody else to know what Snowden has if he can know it by himself. So that would be a very smart tactical move by saying you can't publish any of this stuff anymore. You know, the bottom, what he's not saying is we don't want anybody else to know what these secrets are. We'd like to know them ourselves. And at the same time, he's making himself look good in the eyes of the Americans by shutting him up. So it's an interesting, you know, what's going to happen. I mean, right now, the problem is he can't fly anywhere because if he tries to get on a commercial airliner, it's going to fly over airspace that the U.S. has already convinced the countries to shut down.
Right.
You know, I mean, maybe if he gets temporary access into Russia, he can go to a port, like a Black Sea port, get on a ship. The ship will stay in international waters the whole time, freight ship or whatever, sails through the Black Sea, sails through the Mediterranean, and sails through Gibraltar and the Atlantic to Venezuela or something.
Right.
Who knows?
Right.
So at least it gives him more options by getting a temporary asylum in Russia. The whole thing is just so bizarre because here's the U.S. government that, because of their actions now, has forced this guy into getting asylum in Moscow.
Yeah, there's this kind of catch-me-if-you-can game going on right in the media, but it's interesting. We'll keep watching it, of course, and see what happens with the story. But let me mention your books, James, here at the end as well. The Shadow Factory, your most recent book, and then before this specific one, NSA Alone, then you have Body of Secrets, and then also The Puzzle Palace. Where can people go to pick up copies of your books if they want to read more about your work, James?
Well, I think they're all available now on Amazon. You can get all those books on Amazon these days. The two most recent Wired articles I did were cover stories last year and this year. And there you could get those on the Wired website, Wired US website. All that is. And also I did a documentary for PBS on this, on NSA, that was based on my last book. The documentary is called The Spy Factory. It was on PBS, and I assume you'd be able to get that by just going to the PBS website. And if you type Bamford and The Spy Factory, you should be able to get it. But I appreciate being on your show. It's a lot of good questions.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll link to those stories as well, by the way, for our listeners. You can click through our website, redicecreations.com, easily from there. Well, thank you for your time, James. Really appreciate it. Please keep up the good work, and thank you for coming on once again.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Before we round things up here for today, then, I just want to let you know that next with us, we have Lennon Honor on the program to talk about family, manhood, role models, the war between the sexes, and also the media trauma-based mind control surrounding terrorist events. We have, after this, Adrian Salbucci, Jeffrey James, and Larkin Rose, to name a few. My special thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John. Take good care, and we will speak to you soon. Have a good one.